From the crowded hallways of the largest outlet mall in the nation, Sawgrass Mills and Sunrise, to the high-priced luxury of Ball Harbor Shops, ringing up the highest sales per square foot in the world, South Florida boasts one of the most dynamic retail industries across the globe. I'm Tom Hudson. Coming up on the Sunshine Economy, it's the reality of retail in South Florida. High-end retailers are flocking to our region to capture local consumers, but to tap into international tourists. Meantime, two independent retailers selling music and books are surviving with brick-and-mortar stores in this internet age. It's all ahead on the Sunshine Economy, the reality of retail in South Florida, next on WLRN. This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. It's the reality of retail in South Florida. Tourism and real estate are two of the biggest things going for South Florida's economy, and they have been for a long, long time. Both exert their influence on the retail industry here. Keith Koenig certainly knows it. He's president of City Furniture. Now, if you lived in South Florida back in the 1970s, and you were hip, you were cool, you may have bought a waterbed from him and his brother. In 1971, Waterbed City opened in Fort Lauderdale. You're not sleeping on one.
You're just right now, there are two great reasons to invest in a Waterbed City waterbed.
This was back in the early 1980s. Koenig's company started with less than $10,000, riding in the wave of a growing population in South Florida and a booming housing market. By the 1990s, the waterbed market had sunk, housing had experienced a bust, but Koenig and his family refocused the business and changed the company's name to City Furniture.
City Furniture has irresistible prices.
Sounds like the 1990s there, doesn't it? Well, housing recovered, the business continued growing, and this year its 14 stores will sell a combined $270 million worth of couches, bedroom sets, lamps, and furniture. Much like the sound of its jingles maturing through the years, its business is as much a reflection of local tastes in South Florida as it is the local housing market.
Celebrate the last days of summer during City Furniture's Labor Day sale.
Koenig has seen a lot of trends come and go in South Florida retailing through the years. Today, he uses two words to describe his outlook: very positive.
I think we're in for a few years of really solid growth because the housing market has been so underbuilt, and now we're seeing the beginning of a recovery.
What are customers coming to you for today, and how has that changed from, say, 4 years ago when the bubble had burst in housing?
The furniture customer is now shopping more for whole home, and they're furnishing new and resale purchases of homes and condominiums. So we're getting higher average sales, and we're also seeing the customers more willing to go to more upscale brands, like we recently instituted Bernhard, a big collection of the best of the highest priced furniture lines in the market.
What are your customers telling you about feeding that desire? Where is that coming from? Is it pent-up demand, or certainly it's got to come from some confidence they have in their ability to pay in the future?
I think the market is being driven by demographics. First of all, you have the baby boomers wanting to come to Florida. You have the pent-up demand of South Florida. We've heard about so many Gen X and Gen Y living with their parents. So that household formation is really kicking in. You're seeing home prices have gone up, so people who were trapped in their homes that really wanted to upscale or downscale or downsize now are able to have a little bit more flexibility. So there's a lot of things that are working, and it's all positive for the housing market.
What kind of average ticket are you seeing as a customer leaves a City Furniture store after making a purchase?
Our average sale is close to $1,500, but there's a variety of purchases within there. There's some customers that are buying $25,000, and there's some people coming in and buying a $39.95 accessory. So overall, our average ticket is up about 7-8% over a year ago, which was up about 5-6% over the prior year. So we're seeing some tendency for larger average purchases, but there's the frequency or the modality of more people buying a lot of furniture at once is going up.
So the average receipt is going up. What about the volume of merchandise that's going through your stores to talk to the modality?
Yeah, yeah. Our sales are up on average in the 13-17% range. The biggest comp store increases we've seen for several years.
Compared to the years of 2008, 2009, really the depth of the housing recession here in South Florida, how has your customer changed? How has the merchandise changed that you're selling to that customer? And has the sales process changed?
When the market trended down so dramatically, we definitely saw the customer trade down. So the customer for a $799 sofa was buying a $599 sofa. The $599 sofa customer is buying a $399 sofa. The most promotional products were selling like the best. Now we're seeing a much broader range of purchase preferences, all the way to Bernhardt, which is our new high-end gallery line, and all ranges are doing well now, thankfully. We are very close to the housing market because we are now doing, we're fortunate enough to be doing a lot of models for major builders, and I can tell you the home builders are on fire.
South Florida has a very diverse population. How challenging is that for a retailer that's trying to literally get into their homes, homes of people that have very different experiences in terms of what they want in their furnishings?
It's a good challenge, but it's fun. If you went to our showrooms in Naples and Fort Myers, our cottage, coastal, white, lighter finish furniture appeals to that Midwestern couple that might be retired and is moving south for a second home or maybe a primary home. If you're talking about a condominium on Biscayne Bay, our most modern and contemporary and lacquer and white leather furniture sells off the charts. So there's really a surprising mix of style and demand across South Florida, and what's selling well in some markets is not selling well in others. It gives our merchandising people plenty of reason to want to focus on continuing to broaden our assortment.
And where is that focus going, do you think, for the rest of this business year for you?
It's really going in a couple of different directions. There's more and more modern, and the coastal looks for our Stewart showrooms, Northern showrooms. There's really two categories there. There's a lot of furniture styles, but modern is very popular right now. Every Gen X, every Gen Y associate at City Furniture, and we hire more college graduates, I think, than any other furniture store in the country. We recruit from colleges. So we've got this wonderful pipeline of young talent. They all want modern in their homes and condominiums. Conversely, you go to Naples and Fort Myers, it's a different story.
You sell throughout the region. How is selling furniture in South Florida unique compared to your other locations?
South Florida is unique because of the diversity. It's most unique because of the diversity. And you get into Miami-Dade when you've got a more than 60% Hispanic market. It's so much fun. You go into our Hialeah City Furniture showroom, and you don't have to sell mom and dad. You've got to sell mom and dad, grandma, Aunt Nina, a whole host of kids, and everybody gets a vote. And it's such a great family environment. It's a little bit of a challenge, but it's so engaging. It's so much fun.
What are you experiencing in terms of your product costs? And what are some of the pressures that you're seeing from your suppliers?
Everybody's talking about prices going up, but we haven't seen a whole lot. And we push back a fair amount because we're really the agent for the customer. I make a couple of visits over to our factories throughout Asia every year. I'm going again next month. I'm really going to be paying attention to what that conversation is. Fortunately, we haven't seen costs go up very much at all.
I know in some manufactured industries, the labor cost in China especially has begun to see some significant inflation. But you're saying you haven't experienced that?
I hear that, and I know that to be a fact when I go over and visit. They all tell me that their labor costs are going up 15-20% per year. When it gets right down to it, the market has still been pretty tough so that everybody's fighting for as much business as they can. So there's that competitive aspect that works. I mean, I've seen from several of our suppliers 1, 2, 3% increases, but overall I would say the total impact in product inflation over the last year is less than 2%.
Keith, I want to ask you about hiring. You mentioned earlier being a significant source of jobs or college graduates for City Furniture. Assess the level of retail talent that you're able to tap into as you look for new employees.
With unemployment as high as it is, most people will be surprised to hear that when I network with other furniture and car retailers and other big ticket looking for capable and qualified sales associates, most of us find we have to really look quite a bit to get the quality of associates. We recruit very carefully, and we're concerned about the quality of associates, so we're very selective, as most good companies are. And it's not so easy. There's not an abundance of talent. That's why we go after college recruiting in a big way.
What do you attribute that lack of significant amounts of new talent to?
It's a little bit of a dichotomy for me. We're still scratching our heads, but it's the reality. And it's not just South Florida. I network with furniture retailers across the country. I can think of my friend Rita and Rick Case, and a lot of times Rita comes to me and she shakes me by the lapel and says, "Keith, we need to find more good sales associates." And I talk to my friends at another major furniture retailer in South Florida, and he's saying, "I've got a lot of open positions right now, but we can't get the quality of talent that we would like." I can't quite explain why that is.
You're involved with the community, not only the local community, but the broader community. What would you say to that community in terms of the level of talent that a City Furniture and a Case Honda are having difficulty in finding those kinds of qualified folks for open job positions, open opportunities?
I think we always have to look at our educational system, and we've got to look at the quality of education we're providing our young people. I'm not a critic of that by any stretch of the imagination, but we all know that education is the big equalizer. And we also have to look at individual personal responsibility. Our expectations for someone are pretty significant. Maybe some of the folks today don't quite share those, and so it's a little bit of a challenge for us.
One of the interesting things about the furniture business, as the Great Recession hit, you continued to open up new stores and expand. Has that paid off?
We have. We've taken a long-term point of view, and we've expanded our store footprint. We've continued to reinvest in our infrastructure, and I can tell you that it was challenging a lot of times to do so, and we had to postpone some of the things that we would have done earlier. But we always try to take a long-haul point of view and try to look from the standpoint of the customer. They want the nicest showroom they can shop at. The environment is very important for them. The quality of everything that we do is very important, so we continue to invest. I think the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, I specifically think the next 2 or 3, 4 years in South Florida are really going to be good. Mm-hmm. I think the pent-up demand, the underbuilding of housing, the demographic trend for baby boomers wanting to come into Florida, and I think a rising price of home values are all going to work in favor of the real estate market. And so it's not just furniture in South Florida. It's the carpet guy. It's the wood floor guy. It's the granite countertop guy. And that business is important in our South Florida marketplace. Those entrepreneurial, smaller businesses really help fuel our economy.
That's the tale of the Sunshine Economy here today on WLRN. It's the reality of retail in South Florida. That was Keith Koenig. He's president of retailer City Furniture. He's been retailing here in the region since the early 1970s. He also tells me they are going online. Their internet sales, the fastest growing part of its business, but remains overall a small piece of its total business. The company, though, has been building out its online capabilities. Every retailer wants to go digital more and more. City Furniture is expanding its delivery area so it can expand into new cities without actually having to build and pay for a store. No bricks and mortar, just delivery. Join the conversation at WLRN.org. It is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. We're on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Give us your description of retail in 5 words. Arnold Diamond tweeted this: service, poor. Products, foreign. Presentation, uninteresting. South Florida attitude stinks, is what he tweets us. Join that conversation at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Still to come on the program, the reality of retail here in South Florida means shopping malls. We visit 2 very successful malls, but with very different personalities.
They like to actually load their suitcases up while they're shopping and then roll them right with them to the airport.
I belong in Lincoln Road and will be here for a while.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Big retail in South Florida means shopping malls. It means acres and acres of parking lots, miles of hallways, but it also means sidewalks and local shops battling for real estate with national brands. Two particular malls here are among the most successful retail destinations, but with very different identities. The Miami Herald's Karen Rundlett visited both.
Sawgrass Mills may have begun as an outlet mall, but it has been attracting more luxury retail names, names like Prada and Gucci. They are following the tourist retailer dollar to Sunrise. The mall takes up 2.5 million square feet. It's regularly compared to Disney as a tourist attraction, and every day it's got plenty of these rolling through it. That's the sound of suitcase wheels.
Every day I say, my God.
Oscar Etienne works at Carry On. It's a kiosk store that sells rolling suitcases. You know, they call them spinners.
The tourists come to buy more suitcases.
They like to actually load their suitcases up while they're shopping and then roll them right with them to the airport.
And that's Luann Lenberg. She's general manager of the entire mall, a big job she's compared before to running a small city, especially during the holiday season. I'd heard about the Sawgrass suitcase phenomenon, but I wasn't sure I'd spot one during my Wednesday morning visit. It was a weekday when the mall tends to be quieter. Most of the suitcase shoppers I approached didn't want to try their English with my microphone.
Yes.
Are you shopping? No. You're
no.
Not shopping? Oh,
no.
Okay. Is she shopping? Are you together?
No.
Okay. Excuse me. Hi. Are you shopping today?
Oh, I don't speak English.
Okay. All right.
Sawgrass Mills is known for attracting visitors from countries like Germany, Brazil, Venezuela, France. And most of these international shoppers spend more money in one visit than any local does. Of course, they don't visit as often. The mall is also seeing a new surge in shoppers from Asia, particularly Japan and Korea. To keep things fresh, Sawgrass Mills has been expanding its colonnade shops. For those of you who don't know, that's the stretch of designer stores with brag names like Versace and Tourneau. Just this week, Sawgrass announced Jimmy Choo joined their retail mix.
All the stores are here.
Silvia Belgiudice is a shopper visiting from the Dominican Republic. She sounds like a commercial for the place.
Do you come to Sawgrass Mills a lot?
Every time that I come to Florida, yes.
Is there one thing in particular that you remember that you bought for someone or for yourself that you loved?
Yes, a watch.
Do you spend too much?
Yes.
Proof that shopping for deals isn't unique to the American consumer. While Sawgrass Mills sells power shopping, Lincoln Road Mall sells a scene. Besides retailers, the iconic strip is home to cafes, nightclubs, galleries, and the New World Symphony. People often just sit or stroll. But Gratiano Sprogio, he remembers when this place was dead.
There was just about to finish the renovation, and there was still a lot of empty space.
It was the 90s.
And Lincoln Road was still a virgin area, if I can call it that way. One of the things that attracted me the most is to create a cafe area without traffic nearby.
16 years ago, Sprogio moved his restaurant from Ocean Drive to Lincoln Road Mall, Tiramisu. Today, he owns the restaurant and three other cafes on Lincoln Road, including Van Dyke. Sprogio will tell you he worked his way up.
And I started working at Tiramisu. When I say working at Tiramisu, taking order at the table.
His success in the restaurant industry parallels Lincoln Road Mall's rise as a commercial retail strip. The street is tops on the wish lists of many big retailers. Brands know tourists spend big dollars here.
There's still the locals that come, maybe not as frequent because they have other areas to discover, but there is no one tourist that comes to East Miami that will not walk to Lincoln Road.
Retailers on Lincoln Road ring up sales that rank among the top five shopping streets in the country. That's why brands like Armani Jeans and Lush Cosmetics wanted in. It's now fair to compare sales at Lincoln Road to streets like Chicago's Michigan Avenue or Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. Of course, it comes at a price. Many of the funky boutiques, the artists, and the mom-and-pop kitchens of yesteryear have been priced out, which makes Sprogio's longevity even more impressive. Tiramisu is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year.
Do you think you'll be on Lincoln Road forever?
Well, Yes, but let me define a little bit more my answer. I would say that business-wise, personally, I start on Lincoln Road. I belong on Lincoln Road and I will be here for a while.
Established businesses and powerhouse brands are the ones who can afford the rent these days. From the WLRN Miami Herald Newsroom, I'm Karen Rundlett, reporting for the Sunshine Economy.
As with all things real estate in South Florida, location helps determine price. The side streets along Lincoln Road Mall can be considerably less expensive than having a Lincoln Road address, sometimes up to half the rent. Now, in Sunrise at Sawgrass Mills, the management there says instead of working to entice retailers to locate there, as is the practice for many other shopping malls, it actually has a waiting list of retailers when store space opens up. This is the Sunshine Economy, the reality of retail in South Florida. Join the conversation, a live chat on WLRN.org, and tweet your thoughts at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. How do you describe retail experience in South Florida? Still to come, we visit one more local shopping destination. Just do not call it a mall.
The vast majority of our tenants consider that to be a four-letter word.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. We're talking about the reality of retail in South Florida on WLRN.org and on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Tell us your retailing experience. Stand up for a second and put your feet together. Now look down. That's approximately 1 square foot. That space means almost $2,800 of retail sales a year at Bal Harbor Shops in Bal Harbor. A square foot is an important metric in retail. It's how you measure the size of stores, but it's also how you compare how much a store sells at one location compared to another location. So at almost $2,800 of sales per square foot, Bal Harbor is credited as the most productive shopping center in the world. The average for a shopping center is closer to $450 per square foot. Matthew Whitman Lazenby is the operating partner and the third generation to run the place. Matthew, Bal Harbor Shops is seen as a real beacon of high-end retailing. How did it get to that place, and where is it going?
The vision was instantaneous in the sense that my grandfather in the 60s always knew what he wanted. The execution of that vision did not happen overnight. That's been a 50-year work in progress. We opened in 65, so we're approaching our 50-year anniversary here pretty shortly. I think the differentiating factor for us, and really for all destinations that from the get-go desire to be luxury driven, is a realization of and then a dependence upon tourists. We have a affluent local customer that's very important to us, that's very loyal to us. We hope to be very loyal to him and her in return, but this shopping center depends upon its tourist base.
What is that revenue mix that comes from local shoppers compared to those who are visiting?
So had you asked me that question 2 years ago, prior to the most recent market survey that we conducted, I probably would have told you somewhere between 50 and 60% is what we sort of anecdotally imagine. In most shopping centers, when you can brag about double-digit tourism, 10%, 15%, that's a big deal. So 50 to 60% is practically unheard of, maybe Las Vegas, Hawaii, maybe some destinations like that. But our market studies actually show us that between 70 and 80% of our customer is a market visitor, which means that they're not coming from the primary trade area. So that could be seasonal residents, that could be people that are coming from Boca Raton or places that aren't sort of home base for us.
How does that change your approach to retailing for your tenants?
When you're targeting a more static local consumer whose tastes evolve and you know whose wants do change, they don't change as erratically as a customer base that's coming from all over the world, right? So you do have to try to be in tune, not just with sort of local trends, but more global trends, because your customer is very much a global customer. So from a merchandising perspective, you kind of have to have a very much global awareness of what people want. And the way we have tended to do that over the years is that most of our stores are imported from retail markets throughout the world that we deem to be comparable or frankly that we aspire to. So locations like Fifth Avenue and Madison Avenue in New York, Rodeo Drive, to a lesser extent, the Boston and Chicago and Las Vegas markets. And increasingly now that Miami has become a true gateway city, we're making more and more trips to Paris and Milan and London, et cetera.
The hallways of Bal Harbour shops are filled with those global high-end luxury good retailers, the companies that you see in the pages of French Vogue and these really high-end places. How do you attract them here, and what's the value proposition that this little shopping mall in Dade County presents to them?
This is a shopping mall in the sense that it's owned by one entity. In this case, it's a family. But I will tell you that the vast majority of our tenants consider that to be a four-letter word. They do not consider Bal Harbour Shops to be a mall. Many of the highest-end brands still won't really go into malls. Some of them will. Some of them have, as the old sort of haute couture houses have been consolidated into conglomerates that are owned by even larger companies. Some of that resistance has gone away, and it's been fueled more and more by growth. But still, the brands don't consider this to be a mall. And that has served to benefit us, frankly, because usually in this country, New York remains the sort of the proving grounds, right? That's where those folks that are coming from Europe and South America want to establish their brands first. And frankly, as the saying goes, if you can make it there, you really can make it anywhere, because those rents are so prohibitive that you really have to know what you're doing. So for us, when stores succeed in New York City, and when we feel like there is the likelihood that they'll be as successful for our market here, we feel very confident leasing to that particular store, because it's already sort of jumped over that significant obstacle.
Bal Harbour Shops generates the highest revenue per square foot of any shopping center right across the globe. What's that message that it sends to the broader community of the locals that work here, that depend upon the stores and the owner for their livelihood?
Because this is barely a 16-acre site, we have jammed a lot of productivity onto a very small parcel. So the village of Bal Harbour is tiny. It's about a square mile. And so Bal Harbour Shops is very much a regional destination. Frankly, it's an international destination. The community definitely benefits from the success of the shopping center through things like resort taxes and impact fees and other things. The local government benefits, of course. The county and the state then benefit even further from sales taxes and things like that. And in fact, we are planning an expansion of the shopping center. So as I said, we're about 450,000 square feet today. Going forward, we intend to add around 230,000 square feet to that. So that will even further broaden that impact.
That's about a 50% increase in square footage from what this destination has traditionally had.
It is.
Obviously a very bullish, very optimistic plan that you have for the market to be able to absorb that.
It is indeed. 50% growth is not something to sneeze at. But still, for a 450,000 square foot shopping center, that still puts us between 600,000 and 700,000 square feet. So we'll still be intimate in terms of other shopping centers in the area with which you might be familiar that are well over a million square feet. And that's important to us because I think that intimate ambiance is meaningful to our customer. In terms of meeting market demand, there are multiple factors at play there. Firstly, because our existing tenants are so successful, it's hard to find one that doesn't want to be bigger and a lot bigger. So we really easily could fill up all of that additional square footage. And so when I say 200 to 230,000 square feet, a significant component of that will go towards one large anchor store. So we're really looking at somewhere between 100 and 150,000 square feet of mall stores. We could lease all of that just to our existing tenants who all want to get bigger, no problem. That wouldn't be what was best for the shopping center, because certainly there is a point of diminishing returns where a store gets bigger and isn't quite able to keep up that same productivity. So in addition to allowing the stores that need to be bigger to get bigger, but there's also a long waiting pool of very high-end tenants who belong in Bal Harbour Shops but who we just can't accommodate today.
Have to ask about the anchor tenant. Under active negotiations with several stores, or have you identified already that anchor tenant for this expansion?
We are under active negotiation with several stores. We've certainly zeroed in on a couple.
Given the international audience that comes to Bal Harbour, is this third anchor store coming into the United States from outside? Could it be an international name?
It could be an international name. That's not our preference.
There's three names that come to mind internationally. I just have to ask. I mean, Harrods, Marks & Spencer, and Cortez & Glace. Are any of those three in the mix?
Those are certainly the top three international brands that would come to my mind also. I don't want to say that we're actively just discussing concepts with any of them, but I don't want to say that we aren't. Because of the affiliation between Neiman Marcus Group, and of course Neiman Marcus itself and Bergdorf Goodman, the Bergdorf Goodman conversation has been an ongoing one, frankly, over a number of years with Neiman Marcus. The extent to which they'd be willing to see that grow outside of Manhattan is always the question. Bloomingdale's is certainly another possibility. Those conversations have been ongoing, and then Barney's. New York. Those would be the most likely domestic candidates. And then once you look at international, I think your list is pretty accurate.
What is your sense of the ability for your tenants to find qualified employees in the local workforce? And what are the experiences that you have as a family-run business finding local talent?
Truthfully, it's not easy. It's a very common complaint that we hear from our tenants, to be honest with you, particularly our restaurant tenants. The labor force in the region is not great. Because we have such a broad demographic and such a broad audience, our stores need to have very, very well-educated, very talented, very specialized salespeople. For example, in a market that's as heavily influenced by Brazilians as this one is, stores really should have a Portuguese-speaking sales associate. So someone who speaks Portuguese in this market is in very high demand. But also we have a very significant Russian population. So somebody who speaks Russian is in very high demand. And even though many of our customers, if not most of them, can also speak English, there's obviously a familiarity and a conversational tone that you're able to develop if you speak in somebody's home tongue.
Where do you see retailing in this local market headed? We've seen the large retail corporations move into Lincoln Road Mall. We've seen other more regional type of shopping destinations become real corporate destinations on corporate retail. You certainly have been feeling and seeing luxury goods, global manufacturing brands coming in here. Where is retailing in South Florida headed?
Any kind of retail, but particularly retail that's more skewed towards luxury, it is dependent upon tourists. It just is. Over the years, there have been would-be imitators to Bell Harbor Shops that wanted to sort of do Bell Harbor Shops somewhere else in other parts of town. In the 80s, it was a combination of Omni in the northern parts of Miami, Mayfair in Coconut Grove, and Coral Gables, the Village of Merrick Park, came later in the late 90s, early 2000s. You can have your own opinion on how well those projects did. Two of the three aren't around anymore, so I guess you really can't have your own opinion on those two. But I would argue that to the extent that they didn't get quite what they intended to achieve, it was because they couldn't get those tourists. The extent to which some of the other projects that are either contemplated or are under development in town are able to get tourists, then they will be successful. If they're not able to get tourists, then they won't. It really is as simple as that.
Still to come here on the Sunshine Economy, more on the reality of retail in South Florida, including how two independent stores, a local bookshop and music store, are surviving in this age of digital media and online shopping.
I think the city definitely needs more visionary landlords who are willing to have reasonable rent rates and aren't just trying to make a money grab, because independent businesses are the souls of communities. I'm sorry, but Chili's is not the soul of a community.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. The reality of retailing in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Many of us used to hear this when we bought books or music. We'd browse through the stacks, maybe talk to a clerk, spend some time with the book or compact disc, make our way to the counter, check out at a real cash register, and would hear the receipt printing out. But for more and more book and music buyers, this is the sound of making a purchase. It's a computer mouse clicking through an online music store like iTunes or looking through the Readers Also Bought section at Amazon.com. Online retailing has changed the book and music retailing business like no other. Borders, Books, and Music went broke. Tower Records and Virgin Megastores went bust. Where big national retail chains have failed, two South Florida companies are surviving. Music fans of the analog age will recognize the familiar sound of a record player scratch and the turntable, a real turntable, not a digital representation of one on a screen, spinning endlessly at the end of a vinyl LP.
My name is Lauren Ruskin, and I am the owner and co-founder of Sweat Records.
Ruskin is a native South Floridian with music in her blood. Her grandmother was a concert violinist. Her father is a professional trumpet player. She founded Sweat Records in 2005 with a partner and about $45,000. Less than a year later, the store was hit by Hurricane Wilma. Ruskin has had to move the store twice, deal with burglaries, and of course, the continued migration of music buyers online.
Tell me how you've been able to put Sweat Records, a vinyl record store, on the map in Miami here in 2013 in the age of digital, iTunes, downloads, Spotify, streaming, Pandora.
Well, from the beginning, we've been very community-oriented. The store was basically started because Miami didn't have a store like this, and as a city as large as Miami, in my opinion, especially because it's my hometown, needed one. When Sweat opened, we were all about being inclusive, open to new ideas, listen to our customers. I knew there were enough people in Miami with good taste in music and who were passionate about music to support a store like ours, and it worked.
Industry-wide, music industry revenues are becoming more and more concentrated in digital form. For every dollar spent on music last year in the United States, 60 cents of it was spent on subscription streaming music internet services and point-click-and-buy websites. But there's a throwback music buyer that's growing. While a much smaller dollar amount, sure, the sales of vinyl records grew by more than 35% last year.
So many new people getting into vinyl, new labels, new pressing plants, all kinds of interest in it. And it's just a great thing for the format, and I think a great thing for music and music lovers.
About 85% of the music in the stacks at Sweat Records in Miami is on vinyl, a share that has continued to grow over the past several years.
With the times and the demand that we've seen from our customers, we've allocated more room to vinyl because that's what people want.
So tell us what business is like here at Sweat Records in the middle of 2013. How is business?
It's pretty good. It's continuing to grow. We sell a lot more turntables now, which every turntable we sell is a new customer that hopefully will continue shopping with us. I think people are continuing to step into the format. I find it just a sexy format. It's attractive, vinyl. Comes in different colors and different weights. There's a lot of nuance to it, and people are discovering that, and that's really cool.
Ruskin has had help along the way. Sweat Records has won two Night Arts Challenge grants totaling $290,000 for its community programs like its annual Sweatstock Music Festival, an online store selling Made in Miami music, books, and art. As any brick-and-mortar retailer will tell you, one of their biggest investments and expenses is their inventory, what they have on their shelves.
What's an album that you want to be sure to have
all the time,
in stock all the time?
Well, we'll never stop selling Abbey Road or Pet Sounds. And I think that's really cool because, a 50-year-old will buy it to have a day of nostalgia, and then a 15-year-old buy it because they've heard their whole growing up that this is the best album ever.
Just as younger people are discovering things like vinyl, they've also discovered books, even though they're so wired into everything. There is this kind of counter movement away from all things digital.
That's Mitchell Kaplan. He founded the bookstore Books and Books back in 1982. He now has four stores in South Florida. He also has a licensing partnership with four more. Kaplan has found a way to survive by selling books in actual stores, despite the onslaught of pressure, first from big national bookstores and then by Amazon.com.
We've invested in the ambience of our stores. We've invested in the selection that we have.
Like Sweat Records, Kaplan says a big part of his strategy is community involvement in ways big stores can't. Service, knowing your local customer, giving people reasons to come into the store and buy. And also like Lauren Reskin at Sweat Records, Kaplan at Books & Books would like to see more acknowledgement on the part of the local real estate community of the role for local retailers.
There needs to be ways through zoning, through special kinds of tax incentives to be able to attract and keep small business. Because if you look all around South Florida, small business is disappearing in many places. Just take a look at Lincoln Road. See what's happened over the years because of the intense pressure on rents.
Kaplan certainly knows firsthand with one of his stores on Lincoln Road. In the battle between real estate prices and what we'll call the blanding of retail districts, Kaplan argues small independent shops provide a distinctive quality for shopping areas, giving them something only a local retailer can. So what's that distinctive book Kaplan always wants to have on his bookstore shelves?
For those of us in South Florida, I would always make sure that I kept two mysteries on my shelves. One is La Brava by Elmore Leonard, who unfortunately recently passed, and the other would be Miami Blues by Charles Williford. Two novels which really talk about a South Florida life that doesn't exist anymore. Come together right now
over me. Mitch Kaplan of Books & Books, Lauren Reskin of Sweat Records, trying to run community oriented retailers here in South Florida. Kaplan of Books & Books says about half of all book retailing buying happened at independent bookstores like his back in the 1980s. That's dwindled to under 10% today. Still to come here on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN, the battle between online and in-store shoppers.
The online outfits are really beating the locals the old-fashioned way by providing services and merchandise the locals have been unwilling to make available.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Every retailer we spoke to for the program has a digital strategy. About three-quarters of the shopping that Gerald Kratz does online is online, and it's growing. He's a member of our Public Insight Network, and for those local stores missing Gerald from their aisles, he offered this, why he's doing more and more of his shopping on the Internet.
It's not the convenience that draws us, even though the prospect of 24-hour access and the ability to buy without having to venture forth into traffic and crowded malls is very attractive. And it's not the price. Even though sites like Amazon can usually undercut the locals, we are not particularly price sensitive as long as we don't feel like we are being ripped off. What it is selection.
So it's selection, the variety of items for sale, the sheer volume of things for sale online, page after web page. It just cannot be matched by any brick-and-mortar store. For others, like Eric Moss, a retired high school teacher from Miami Shores, it is about price, and wherever they find the lowest price wins their business.
If the price of an item that I want, including shipping, is lower than what I can get it for the same item at a local retailer, I would definitely buy it online.
It's all about price for Eric. Price and selection are two key points of competition for South Florida's retailers, in-store versus online. Ann wrote us, I buy most of my books online from Barnes & Noble, but I am beginning to rethink that habit, and perhaps I may begin to buy at local bookstores. She goes on to add, while we still have local bookstores. Now, there's also the practice of showcasing. Now, you've probably done this without actually knowing it was called showcasing. Leslie emailed us this example. I only go into stores, Leslie wrote, to touch and feel the merchandise before buying online. Back to Gerald Kratz for a moment, the gentleman from Miami who told us he's buying more and more online. He has a heck of a diverse shopping list, but he has felt no desire to touch and feel before buying.
I can order mangosteens from Southeast Asia and have them delivered by air overnight, or buy a 100-year-old book on the history of the caliphate from a dealer in Nevada, or a heavy-duty Milwaukee electric jackhammer from Amazon.com, both items delivered to my door within 48 hours.
Certainly no brick-and-mortar retailer could offer such a wide variety of items that Gerald has been shopping for online. Presumably, he doesn't use all three of those at the same time. Gerald Kratz, one of our Public Insight Network folks here on WLRN with the Miami Herald. This is the Sunshine Economy, and I'm Tom Hudson. We're talking about the reality of retail in South Florida. The conversation on WLRN.org, on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Blair tweeted this: the reality of shopping in South Florida? Buy everything online. Certainly more and more of us are doing it, and how to get people in stores online and how to get them to buy a key focus of retailers here in South Florida. Consider this, that online sales are growing very, very fast, up almost 20% nationwide in the second quarter of this year alone compared to just 1 year ago, a 20% increase in retail sales. Most retailers would fall over themselves for that kind of year-over-year growth. But as Americans, now we spend more than $1 trillion in retailing every 90 days. Every quarter, more than $1 trillion. Of course, the fourth quarter, we spend a lot more thanks to the holidays. So we spend $1 trillion in the second quarter. A little over a nickel of every dollar was spent online. Consider that for a moment as you're hearing some digital strategies from retailers. 95 cents of every dollar in retailing is still spent in brick-and-mortar stores. We're talking about South Florida retailing here on WLRN and the Sunshine Economy. Ina Cordell with the Miami Herald covers the retail industry and writes about how this movement toward luxury shopping here in South Florida has extended far beyond accessories, jewelry, shoes, clothes. It is now beginning to extend into what we eat, into food, with a high-end chocolatier company in Miami that continues to expand its wholesale business regionally and also continues to expand its business internationally. Ina Cordell, you can read her piece in the Miami Herald. This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Coming up next Monday on the Sunshine Economy, be sure to join us. You know, summer comes to an unofficial end with Labor Day. So we're going to spend the hour looking again at the tourism industry in our region. It began back in 1896. Back in 1896, that's when oil baron Henry Flagler stretched his railroad south and built the Breakers in Palm Beach. Today, Paul Leone runs that hotel, and he has to bring workers in from outside Florida.
There are still a lot of entry-level workforce people who think that waiting tables is not necessarily a good job.
That's next Monday's Sunshine Economy. It's Selling Paradise, Tourism in South Florida. Finally, this retail industry, it may get knocked around for relatively low-paying jobs, and that's true. But all those tourists here in South Florida giving their money to local stores means that much more in sales taxes not coming from those of us calling this place home. This is the Sunshine Economy. It's on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break.